The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
For those of you who have been to Israel, that video might have been very familiar to you. That was taken just out front of the Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv just an hour or so ago here Tuesday afternoon. This is the main airport in and out of Israel, and the protesters are trying to shut it down. People are mad. People are protesting. Increasingly, it seems, the Jewish state has no helper. I'm Brent Nachtigall, filling in for Mr. Stephen Flurry today from Jerusalem, Israel. Thanks very much for joining the Trumpet Daily. The Jewish state has no helper. This is an article in the latest edition of the Trumpet magazine from Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry. The focus of the article, of the whole issue, of course, is this special report that you've seen on the Trumpet Daily being reported on lately, on pride and the assault on marriage and family and children. But towards the end of this magazine, there is an article that might seem out of place in the context of the issue. And yet, looking at what is happening today, this very day, Tuesday, in Israel, it couldn't be more perfectly timed. The Jewish state or the Jewish nation has no helper. What is going on today is a national day of disruption. It comes after this decision by the Knesset late Monday night to advance a bill through its first reading. This is striking down this reasonableness clause that the judges on the Supreme Court have in Israel to adjudicate any decision that comes from the Knesset, which is the parliament, the legislature, the body that makes the laws, to strike down those laws based on their definition of what they seem is reasonable. And so it doesn't matter if there's a landslide approval for some bill or law to come into effect. If the court doesn't like it, it can be struck down. And this is obviously not a democratic, it's not the way democracies work. Generally, the laws that the Supreme Court strikes down from the government, that would have to be adjudicated further based on the law or a constitution. Of course, Israel does not have a constitution, and so the court itself has become a law unto itself. And that is why the government, this government led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has been trying to reform the court, cut back on the court's power. And 3 months ago, this is what this main article is about by Mr. Gerald Flurry. It talks about how there were these bills that were going to get pushed through the Knesset to basically change the way that the Supreme Court elects its judges, because right now the Supreme Court has a veto on the people that come into the court, which allow them to make sure only those that suit their own ideology can come into the court. There's other rules that it wants to change, perhaps that everything is justiciable in this court. Typically, courts have to be applied to, or a case has to go to the Supreme Court based on somebody that has standing, like there's a law that is affecting somebody, and the court will then have to judge on it. But there's no necessary grounds for standing in Israel. Anyone can petition the court with any desire to strike down anything from the government, and then the court can come along and decide upon the case. So imagine this. The court has a bunch of left-wing organizations. The court then gets one of those left-wing organizations to approach the court and bring a case forward. Doesn't matter if there's any standing involved. The court then can say, well, there's a case brought before us. We have to make a judgment on it. And by what laws do we judge that case? By our own definition of reasonableness, by our own definition of human dignity, It's a crazy situation that's developed in Israel, fundamentally because of the lack of a constitution. And then starting in the late 1980s through the 90s into the 2000s, you've had a court go increasingly shifting towards the left and making decisions that would strike down any conservative government that gets into power. And this is the whole reason that most of Israel voted for the Bibi government, the Netanyahu government, in the last election, in what could have been seen as receiving a huge landslide for this reform of the court. You had right-wing governments, and you always hear about this in the media, right-wing governments in Israel. They're getting in, Bibi's back. This is a hawkish prime minister. And yet, what hawkish policies are there? Well, he can't enact them. Why not? Well, because the court's there, standing in its way. And so the conservatives in Israel, the right wing in Israel, and the center right feel disenfranchised that even though they have elections, what they want to happen in the state can't happen. So these protesters are out there right now saying that democracy is dead. And indeed, they're right. Democracy means, if you're going to go straight up by the definition, the rule of the majority. Of course, it needs checks and balances. We're not saying that. But if you look at who holds the power right now, unelected bureaucrats that judge according to their own opinion. And of course, they would say it differently than what I'm saying it right now. Nevertheless, This is the case in Israel. So they want to try and curtail some of the powers of the court. The first is to remove this reasonableness clause. Even this whole idea that a Supreme Court could judge upon the legislature and the laws that are created based on a vague definition of reasonableness is crazy. And the famous almost Supreme Court Justice Robert Bork, constitutionalist in the United States, he had some pretty powerful and strong words to say about this court and what the court and the situation that has now developed. Really, he really did predict what we're seeing take place in Israel right now. And so you might have seen in that clip a lot of Israeli flags waving back and forward. And that's what you have in Israel. When both sides come to protest, everyone brings an Israeli flag. But they're not wanting to stand up for the reform of this court. These people are out there right now protesting against the court and against the reform of the court. And it's actually incredible the power they have. Just before I came to record this, I got a message on my phone. This is from Yesh Atid. I don't know how they got my phone number, but this is the phone number. This is the most popular center-left-wing party of Yair Lapid. He talks about, and he's writing me a message right now, facing the extreme government, we are a democratic liberal camp, and our voice is strong and clear. We will not give up our beloved country. There is a future. Join us. So they've got all the social media that's out there. They've got the text message going out, flooding out to the nation of Israel, trying to get to people to come out and protest. And these protests, they're serious. They're very serious last year. I mean, that's what actually put a halt on everything, put a halt on the reform last time. But they're at it again, and this time they want more. That's why they're at the airport. I mean, in the United States, the UK, you have many airports. It's not a big deal, I suppose, to have one airport shut down. But this is Israel's main artery in and out of the country. It's critical infrastructure. It is against the law to stop the functioning of the Tel Aviv airport. And yet that's exactly what they're trying to do. This is what the Attorney General said in Israel. So typically the Attorney General in a country works for the government. Not in Israel. The Attorney General in Israel works for the Supreme Court. So on Sunday, Prime Minister Netanyahu brings the Attorney General to a cabinet meeting, brings the police chief to the cabinet meeting and talks about, okay, there's this big day of disruption planned on Tuesday. What do you have, what are you looking at to try and stop the country from shutting down because of this protest? And the Attorney General comes out and says this. Of course, it's in Hebrew, so the quote, I'm just going to give it to you, a translation. This is the quote. There can be no effective protest without disturbing the public order. Get that? Normally, protests, you can go on, you can go to the side of the road, you can yell, it's the mass movement of people, you arrange to have this road, perhaps you petition the government, shut down this road, we want to protest through here, protest peacefully. Not according to the Attorney General. If the nation is not disrupted, then it's not an effective protest. She's all for it. Then you have the police chief, he's in a bit of a different situation. This is a police commissioner, Kobe Shabte. He says this, the policy is that it's forbidden to block roads. We could take batons and horses and clear the protest in a minute. But how many injuries would there be? So how we just can't do it. Why? Even though people are breaking the law, we don't want to injure any people. We don't want to stop them from breaking the law, therefore we'll let them break the law. So Netanyahu asked them, okay, so how many indictments were brought down on people? How many arrests were there? And then how many people were charged on the protest in March? And these shut down major arteries, almost shut down the Ben-Gurion airport throughout Israel. Six people ended up had charges being brought to them for assaulting police officers. That's it. So you can shut down a country and it's fine. It's against the law, a law on the books, but it's fine. Because unless there is not disruption to the state, what did she say here? There can be no effective protest without disturbing the public order. That's the Attorney General of Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu responded saying this, that's a shocking sentence. Are you state saying that besieging a barbershop from inches away is legitimate? So this is talking about how in March, the Prime Minister's wife, she went to a hairdresser and she was locked in there for hours. She had to be rescued by hundreds of police to come and remove the protesters that were forcing her to stay there. And so on. He talks about how the government is requesting to see what their policy, see their policies on to make sure that there's order and that there will be no disruption. And except it looks like there's going to be plenty of disruption. How did Israel get to this point? How did it get to this point? Well, that back in 1986 and 87, there was a big swift change on the Supreme Court, led by Aharon Barak. He wasn't the chief Supreme Justice at that time, but he would be. And really, he started to bring in this a couple of new ideas of how to adjudicate cases. There was a basic law that was passed in the middle of the night back in 1993. It was a law on human dignity, and it goes by a different name as well. And he basically said that, wow, this is an amazing power that the government has passed us. This had no really strong power. It wasn't meant to be a constitutional law at all. And yet the justice says that, man, overnight we have a constitution and we can use that. We can use that to make sure and keep this government in check. And this was an incredible danger. And it has gotten worse and worse since then. Robert Bork, I do want to play a couple of clips from him. Sam Livingston has been talking about him a little bit. He died in 2012, and this is a recording in 2010. So you might recall at the time President Obama was in power, Alan Kagan was being nominated for the Supreme Court, and Robert Bork came out as being one of the big dissenters against her confirmation. And why is that the case? Well, Robert Bork was very familiar with what was happening in Israel and very familiar with Alan Kagan and who her hero was, her judicial hero. This is what Alan Kagan, she's in the Supreme Court of the right now in the United States. You can connect the dots here. It's incredible to see how these two nations are connected, the United States and Israel. So you have Dean Kagan, who was of Harvard at the time. She called Aharon Barak the man that led the judicial overhaul that Netanyahu is trying to pull back right now, her judicial hero. She said, the man that has done the most to advance justice, democracy, and the rule of law in the world. That's Barak. That's her chairman. She's a Supreme Court justice right now. And this is what's interesting because, I mean, Sam Livingston, he gave this program on Friday and he talked about how the Supreme Court in the United States is like the last hope. And even Bible prophecy talks about how the Supreme Court is going to be a court that stands up for the rule of law that is left on the books and actually makes some cases, some decisions that are going to be in favor of the conservatives, led by Trump at this point. And that's what he was saying. And yet in Israel, it's the opposite. You have the government in power that's trying to take away the runaway court, the lawless court. And, you know, Elena Kagan, she's there. Obviously, she's not voting with the conservatives on the court in the United States. But if you're going to get some insight into who she likes, it's the man that led the judicial overhaul, the lawless overhaul of the Supreme Court here, Aharon Barak. This was from 2010. He was coming out to support or go against her nomination, Robert Bork, and he did a press conference about this. Here's one quote from Robert Bork at the time. Remember, he's quite old at this point, just a couple of years away from death. And yet he talks about what's going on in Israel. This was 13 years ago. And he is completely right.
But we know now, as we watch Barak, that when the wielder of power becomes the court, there's nobody to say to the court that he shouldn't do whatever it wants. And indeed, the court, as part of its drive for power, has taken over the office of the Attorney General of Israel. So that if the court and the Attorney General disagree with the Knesset, the legislature, there will be no appeal from an adverse decision to the decision adverse to the legislature. The government of Israel is foreclosed from an opportunity to advance its legal arguments before the court. It simply is told it may not litigate. Now, this sounds like a little bit of a parody of a court, but I'm afraid that's exactly what Barak is. He is very popular among left-leaning activists around the world, including in this country. It's quite clear that the Israeli court under Barak, who is without question its leading figure, is the most activist court I've ever seen.
And so that's what we're seeing. Again, that was Robert Bork. He's talking about the most activist court the world has ever seen. And, you know, there are some questions about the court and the rulings that they're making. And it's upsetting the right, it's upsetting the conservatives, so much so that it was, you know, the government coming forward with a policy, Netanyahu's coalition coming forward with a policy, a campaign promise to reform the court that ended the 4 or 5 election cycles that we had back to back to back to back to back. I mean, this is popular with the regular people. I remember about 2 months ago, there was, you know, all you hear in the media over here is, oh, huge protest against the reform that Netanyahu's trying to put through. And this is on all the channels, it's on all the websites, it's hard to get real news these days, increasingly so in Israel as well. And then there was a protest that shut down the center of the city. And I didn't see anything on the news about it. I saw some things on Twitter about it. 150, 200, 300,000 people there. Just you see the drone footage of, again, Israeli flags wagging, flying. And it turns out that this is a pro-reform protest. I didn't get any text messages on my phone from any of the leftist parties saying, come and join us. This was the grassroots, the real grassroots in Israel. The majority of Israel that wants to actually push through some reform. Now, of course, there could be some chance for some compromise on how much the reform is, but this is a popular movement. And so what does Israel do? Where does Israel go to from here? Bitterly divided. Bitterly divided. I mean, you could say it's about the court, but a lot of these same people that are protesting about the decisions of the Netanyahu government to reform the court, they were out protesting in the years prior, before this was even on the table, against any conservative government led by Netanyahu. So it's hard to see that it's anything but a protest against the man in many ways. But what you're seeing in Israel is a divided country. Mr. Gerald Flory, he continues in his article. It says this again is about the Jewish nation, state having no helper. He says, when people openly disobey the law and even the military will no longer defend the country, the nation is in real danger. I mean, you've had reservists saying that they're not going to come to work. You've had pilots of Israel's IDF says we're not going to fly today. What happens today if there's an attack? Mr. Fleury writes, it seems to me that civil war is looming. A few men believe that they have the right to make decisions for the whole country and that no elected leaders can stop them. Democracy has been lost in Judah, just as it is being lost in America. Just really interesting parallels. I do definitely suggest that you read this article by Mr. Gerald Fleury in the latest Trumpet. Again, it's entitled The Jewish Nation Has No Helper. It puts the prophetic context in to show why what's going on in the United States mirrors what's happening in the state of Israel so closely. It's definitely something that you want to read. We'll see where these protests go. Last time, Netanyahu had to basically say, okay, the protesters win for a while, because we can't tear the fabric of Israeli society apart. But what happens then when you can't enact the reforms that a government was elected to do? Well, then the other half of the people feel disenfranchised as well. So this is a dangerous time for Israel. But Mr. Gerald Fleury, in this article, he brings it all together, showing how the United States, the connection between the United States, even the Obama administration, that's all in on these protests. It's very obvious where this government of the United States stands on this issue. And this article, The Jewish Nation Has It, No Helper, puts it all together. Okay, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll switch gears and do a bit of a Bible study and focus on a little bit of some archaeology as well.
The Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily. Imagine having a chapter of the Bible written directly to you. This is what I'd like to talk about in the Bible study portion of today's program. I would like to talk about the man Baruch. He is a very famous individual, at least in the story of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah chapter 45 is directed directly to him. And he, of course, was the scribe of Jeremiah. He wrote down the words of the book of Jeremiah that we have today, and also most likely the book of Lamentations. But he also features in the story and the narrative itself. And this story of Baruch is one that I normally speak about when I tour some of our students or others of the City of David here in Jerusalem, just below the famous stepstone structure, because there was an individual that's mentioned in this account of Baruch that was found in an excavation there in the 1980s, an excavation directed by Dr. Yigal Shiloh of Hebrew University with Ambassador College students in participation back then. And it's a really important story because it talks about and it shows to the degree that God will use these extra figures, if you like, not necessarily the leader that God is using, but also what he expects of those that are called alongside to help. And Baruch, in his personality, we do see a great desire that he had to do wonderful exploits, to go on and become an important individual in his personal field, in his job. And we see him having a bit of a faith crisis because he was called in to support God's work. And he thought that if he threw his lot in with Jeremiah the prophet, that he would not be able to achieve some of the more personal ambition that he had. And God really did want him to pick to serve God's work before anything else that he desired. And so this is a real story. It's a real event. I mean, the book of Jeremiah has been thoroughly proven through archaeology, whether it's talking about the destruction layers of the different cities that were destroyed during Jeremiah's time at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, Jerusalem, elsewhere. We find this big Babylonian period destruction in archaeological excavation. We also find several individuals in excavations that have been discovered by finding these seal impressions, or bullae, as they're known in Hebrew. Jeremiah chapter 38, in the first couple of verses there. There's a couple of individuals that are mentioned, two Judean princes that we actually had on campus in Armstrong Auditorium, Gedaliah, the son of Pashur, and Jeuchal, the son of Shelemiah. These were two of the four people that put Jeremiah in prison. In controlled scientific excavations of Dr. Elot Mazar in 2005 and 2008, these were discovered. First and last names, and in the case of Jeuchal, his third name was his grandfather was even discovered. So these seal impressions over the past 25 years have started to really be discovered, and even in the past two decades to a far greater degree than ever before, really adding to the list of names of proven people from history, from the Bible, outside of the biblical narrative. Of course, if they're in the Bible and you're watching this program, you notably would believe in the accuracy of the Bible, I'm sure. But we've just had an influx of proof, of extra-biblical proof, of biblical figures coming out of the ground in controlled scientific excavations. So to really not believe the book of Jeremiah is an extremely scientifically ignorant position to hold. I know many different archaeologists or biblical scholars over here, many that don't necessarily believe in the miraculous events of the Bible or even the theology of the Bible, but they'll say Jeremiah is a historical book. It's a historical book. We might not believe in the miracles and everything that Jeremiah was saying, but it's a historical book, and they know that. So here we are going back 2,600 years, and we know that the events that Jeremiah writes down, or Baruch writes down in the book of Jeremiah, they happened, without a doubt. If you have any type of worry that this is not a historical book, the book of Jeremiah, cast that aside. This would be a very ignorant position to hold at this time. So back to Baruch now, because this story that I want to talk about, it really does concern a similar time period that we're living through right now. You might remember that the southern kingdom of Judah, after they split, the northern tribes of Israel and Judah and Benjamin and Levi were split by themselves in the southern kingdom, and the David's throne ruled over them, and different dynasties ruled over the northern tribes. And the northern tribes of Israel went into captivity under Assyrian domination in the late 8th century. And then Judah would receive a lease on life, basically, because of the relationship between Isaiah the prophet and Hezekiah and God's miraculous intervention. That's the reason they didn't go into Assyrian captivity. But then 150 years later or so, the Babylonians came along, and they are the ones that started to pressure the southern kingdom of Judah. And if you know biblical history, you know that the Judeans would eventually go into captivity to Nebuchadnezzar's forces, or the Babylonian forces. This is Daniel, the way that how he gets into captivity over into Babylon, how Ezekiel the prophet goes over into captivity as well. How Jehoiachin, he goes, one of the princes or kings, he goes into captivity as well. It's all in this time period of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian taking of Judah. Now, this story I want to talk about, and this history concerning Baruch happens in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Some people can date it to 606, 605, maybe even 607. We're not going to get bogged down into that detail. Nevertheless, everything I'm talking about right now concerning Baruch definitely did happen. And it happened the year in the lead up to the first time that Nebuchadnezzar came and just after. And so this was right on the very edge of when Judah was going to be taken into captivity, and Jeremiah's message had gone out for over a decade to this point, and he was warning people during the reign of Josiah and after. He was warning Judah, he was telling them what was going to happen. After Josiah died, they went past the point of no return, saying that you are going to go into captivity, but you know, after 70 years or so, you'll get to come back. So this was the message of Jeremiah. It was actually a hope-filled message. But Jeremiah was really, for many people, he was scorned, he was laughed at, he was mocked through many of the initial decade that he started his message. And eventually God told him to write the words that you've already said in a book. And this isn't all of the book of Jeremiah. It's only perhaps the first, you know, up to 20 or a bit before that, chapters of the book of Jeremiah. And he commissioned a certain individual to do it. If you've got your Bibles, we'll go to Jeremiah chapter 36 and we'll see this. And again, this is historical, absolutely historical, these events that I'm discussing. It says here, chapter 36 and verse 1, "And it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that this word came unto Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying." So we're in chapter 36. Jeremiah is a little bit out of order as far as chronologically. Nevertheless, this happened in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, around 606, and eventually they're going to go into captivity fully about 20 years after this. But it's going to go in waves, and these waves happened because of God's mercy. God was trying to reach out to certain individuals, reach out to people who would respond to Jeremiah's message. And then, as that would happen, they would go into captivity, and it would be for their own good, because really it was those people that were left in Jerusalem to the very end that would suffer the heartache of the great tribulation during their time. But let's look at this. This is before the waves take place, right? And if we look forward a year or so, the first wave of deportation is going to happen in this fourth year. It says here again, "And it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that the word came unto Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying, take you a roll of a book and write therein all the words that I have spoken against unto you, Jeremiah, against Israel and against Judah." Of course, this tells us that this is a prophetic book. It's just Judah that Jeremiah is talking to. Israel's already gone into captivity. It's showing that this is dual. This is a dual prophecy, not just for the ancient nation of Judah. We'll focus on mainly the ancient application, though. "And against all the nations from the day I spoke unto you, from the days of Josiah, even unto this day." The fourth year of Jehoiakim. So I want you to write these things down. Now, Jeremiah, he's not a writing prophet in the sense that he also is the scribe, perhaps like Isaiah would be. He preached the message, he warned, and then he needed a scribe to help him out. It may be that the house of Judah will hear all the evil which I purpose to do unto them, and that they may return every man... man now from his evil way, that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, Baruch the son of Neriah. And Baruch did it. Baruch was a scribe. He was training to be a scribe. This took a lot of effort and work. He probably belonged to a scribal school, a young up-and-coming scribe. And Baruch wrote from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the Eternal which he had spoken unto him upon a roll of a book. So a scroll. So he's going to write down the first words of the first prophecies of Jeremiah up to that point, so that in the future they can read, and not just in the far future, but perhaps even within the year. They'll be able to read these words, the prophecies of Jeremiah, and some of them would have already came to pass within the year. So this is quite incredible. And verse 5 says, and Jeremiah commanded Baruch, saying, I am shut up. I cannot go into the house of the Eternal. Therefore, go you and read in the roll which you have written from my mouth the words of the Eternal in the ears of all the people in the Lord's house, that's the temple, upon the fasting day. And you shall read them in all the ears of all Judah that come out of their cities. And it may be they will present their supplication before the Eternal, will return everyone from his evil way. For great is the anger and the fury and that the Lord has pronounced against this people. And we'll just stop there. Stop there at verse 7. So Baruch gets called in. He does a marvelous job at writing this out. And then Jeremiah says, I'm shut up, Baruch. I can't go and deliver this message. I want you to go and deliver this message. And not just in a corner. I want you to go right into the temple area. And you're going to speak it in the ears of all the people. And notice again, this was in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Now let's go to Jeremiah chapter 45. Jeremiah chapter 45. So as I said, Jeremiah, chronologically, sometimes it's a little bit out of order. Nevertheless, this is the way the book is put together for good reason. But these from chapter 45 all the way through till almost the last chapter of Jeremiah, it talks about specific prophecies either to individuals, to other nations, and so on. And then it's finally going to conclude with the destruction of Jerusalem and the final captivity of Jerusalem. Notice how this is time-stamped, though. Really important detail here in Jeremiah chapter 45. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spoke unto Baruch the son of Neriah when he had written these words in a book at the mouth of Jeremiah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying. Now, these aren't just minor details here. This is a very important detail. It shows us that in the fourth year, you go back to chapter 36, happening at the same time as this, right? He's commanded to go write it, and he does. Baruch writes it. And then in chapter 36, it says, okay, I want you to go and deliver this message. I want you to go and be a mouthpiece for God's prophet at this point. And did he do it? Now, if you read chapter 36 and you get to verse 8, it just says Baruch goes and does it. But here we have something really interesting happening in chapter 45. This is saying that after he had written these things in a book, still in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, he has a pretty big trial, a very big personal struggle, individual struggle, because he had a decision to make. He aspired for great things, as we'll see. And up to this point, he was basically a scribe for hire. Perhaps he believed a lot of what Jeremiah said would come to pass. Perhaps he was friends with Jeremiah. Perhaps the family was friends with Jeremiah. But really, this was going to be good for his career, and to a certain extent, doing this, writing out this book of Jeremiah. This is a great job for him. Except when Jeremiah the prophet says, now I want you to go and be like me. I want you to go and deliver the message. And that's when Jeremiah chapter 45 takes place, in this fourth year of Jehoiakim. Let's read the rest of this chapter. Thus says the Lord God of Israel unto you, O Baruch. You did say, woe is me now, for the Lord has added grief to my sorrow. This is a depressed man. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest. So this is Baruch wrestling with this idea of having to go and deliver this message, and perhaps having seen what happened, how the scorn that Jeremiah received of his own countrymen, the ostracization of being ostracized by others. Perhaps this was something he didn't want to do. Perhaps he was fearful for any reason. And God sent him a personal message from Jeremiah, and it got in the book. Thus shall you say unto him, this is the message from God to Jeremiah,
to Baruch. Thus, the Lord has said thus, "Behold, that which I have built will I break down, and that which I have planted I will pluck up," or I am plucking up, present tense from the Hebrew, "even this whole land." God was in the process of plucking up the land, of bringing destruction right now, starting upon the land, this very year. I'm in the act of doing it, Baruch. And yet, he was still so part of his world. It wasn't real to him yet. And because of that, you know, he had to come to this decision-making position, this decision point, this inflection point of his life where he had to choose one or the other. And at first, he didn't want to do it. And then God told him, "Don't you realize all these things that you've just written down, I'm actually doing right now?" We'll read verse 4 again. Thus shalt you say unto him, "The Lord has said thus, behold, that which I have built will I break down, and that which I have planted I will pluck up, even this whole land. And seek you great things for yourself." You're still doing your own thing. "Don't you know, Baruch, I'm in the process of plucking up the nation. Nebuchadnezzar's knocking on the door of Judah. And you're still seeking great things for yourself. Seek them not. For behold, I will bring evil upon all flesh, says the Eternal, but your life will I give unto you personally, Baruch. Give unto you for a prey in all the places where you go." Very interesting here for Baruch. Saying, "Baruch, stop seeking great things for yourself. I know you desire to be a wonderful scribe. But this is more important, what I'm doing with you right now. I need you to go and do this, and I'll make you a promise. I'll make you a promise. You go and do what I'm asking you, and I'll give your life as a prize of war," meaning that it might not be easy through these next years, but if you follow me, if you're faithful to me, I will protect you wherever you go. If it's down to Egypt, as he would go, I'll protect you. If it's to Mizpah after Jerusalem falls, I'll protect you. If it's all the way to the Isles, I'll protect you. But this is your chance to stand up. This is your chance to support God's prophet. So this is how Jeremiah 45 ends. Where's the resolution? What happened? Did he respond? Well, of course he did. Of course he did. Jeremiah chapter 36. So we're back here in Jeremiah chapter 36. It starts out in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and chapter 45 happens in the fourth year of Jehoiakim after he had written all these things. Now notice verse 8. "And Baruch the son of Neriah did according to all that Jeremiah the prophet commanded him, reading in the book the words of the Eternal in the Lord's house. And it came to pass in the fifth year of Jehoiakim the son of Josiah, king of Judah, in the ninth month, that they proclaimed a fast before the Eternal to all the people in Jerusalem. To all the people in Jerusalem and to all the people that came from the cities of Judah unto Jerusalem. Then read Baruch in the book the words of Jeremiah in the house of the temple, in the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe." So notice this. Baruch is going, and now we're in the fifth year. The fifth year of Jehoiakim. So reading over this in Jeremiah chapter 36, we might think he was a scribe, he wrote it down, Jeremiah told him to go do it, he did it, everything was wonderful. But here we've got a big time gap. There's 6 months, 8 months, something like that, that's passed. And we need to fill it in with Jeremiah chapter 45 so that we know that Baruch is human. So we know that this was hard for Baruch to decide to count the cost and to decide, well, I'm going to go in, all in with Jeremiah, with God's man. And he eventually did that. But perhaps we see, if we just read chapter 36, we don't see the struggle. We don't see that this was difficult for Baruch. It wasn't an easy decision. He had to cast his lot in with Jeremiah. And that's exactly what he did. Now, this individual, Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe. He comes from a really important family of scribes. Shaphan, you'll recall, belongs to the time period of Josiah. He was the scribe back then. There's a great big family. A lot of these individuals actually knew Jeremiah. They feature in Jeremiah's in the book of Jeremiah, having a relationship with Jeremiah as well. But this individual is important because he's an individual that's been proven as a historical personality outside the Bible. Again, in this excavation of Yigal Shiloh, right there on the stepstone structure below the Palace of David. His first and last name were found in the field amongst over 50 of these seal impressions. And these are impressions that are really small, the size of a penny or so, which are inscribed in clay, and then the clay hardens over time. Perhaps it was fired, or in this case, it was fired in the destruction of Jerusalem in some type of place that was a repository for official documents. And so one of those that was uncovered was Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, right here from this history in Jeremiah chapter 36. So we know this is a real individual. And so he goes to the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, first to preach this message, to read what he wrote from the book of Jeremiah. And when Micaiah, the son of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, heard out of the book all the words of the Lord, then he went down to the king's house into the scribe's chamber. Now, really imagine this. I want you to think about this being him delivering God's message, but notice the way that God is actually organizing the scenario and who the people that Baruch is talking to. It's not just talking to the general public. Of course, that would be done. But he's first giving it in the scribe's chamber. And then the son of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, goes and says, well, this is important. Let's go down to where the big scribes are. These are the big royal scribes of the court of Jehoiakim. And he went down into the king's house, into the scribe's chamber in the king's house, in the palace itself. And lo, all the princes sat there. And one of them was Gemariah, the son of Shaphan. Verse 13, then Micaiah declared unto them all the words that he had heard when Baruch read the book in the ears of the people. Therefore all the princes sent Jehudi, the son of Nataniah, the son of Shelemiah, the son of Cushi, unto Baruch, saying, take in your hand the roll wherein you have read in the ears of the people, and come, come. So Baruch, the son of Neriah, took the roll, his scroll, of the book of Jeremiah, and came unto them. And they said unto him, sit down now and read it in our ears. So Baruch read it in their ears. Now it came to pass, when they had heard the words, they were afraid, both one and another, and said unto Baruch, we will surely tell the king of all these words. And then they asked Baruch something that you might think is a bit strange. They asked him, tell us, how did you write all these words at his mouth? And Baruch answered and said, he pronounced all these words unto me with his mouth, and I wrote them with the ink in the book. You've got this little really interesting tidbit here where he was sitting before the scribes. He was sitting before the royal scribes. These were God, his former God of the scribal authority, was sitting right there in front of him. And he had chosen to actually throw his lot in with Jeremiah. Perhaps he thought he was throwing away all of his potential and future in his scribal endeavor, or in his field of interest. And yet here he was before the royal scribes, and they are amazed. They're amazed, not necessarily, they're amazed at the words of Jeremiah, but they're also amazed of the job that Baruch actually did. They're amazed at his scribal work. And they said, how did you even do this? And then we can just read quick a bit more. It says, and then the princes said unto Baruch, go hide you and Jeremiah, and let no man know where you be. And they went in unto the king into the court, and they laid up the roll in the chamber of Elishama the scribe, and told all the words in the ears of the king. So the king sent Jehudi to fetch the roll, and he came, he took it out of Elishama the scribe's chamber. And Jehudi read it in the ears of the king. And so eventually it's going to go all the way to Jehoiakim itself. So just, again, this is just an amazing personal story of Baruch, and how even though he had decided to throw all his lot in with Jeremiah and support God's work, that his former ambition, God actually made room for some of that inside the work itself. It's incredible. So the king sent Jehudi to fetch her. We read that. Now the king sat in the winter house in the ninth month, and there was a fire on the hearth before him. And it came to pass that when Jehudi had read three or four leaves, that he cut it with the penknife, and he cast it in the fire that was on the hearth until all the roll was consumed in the fire that was on the hearth. Yet they were not afraid, nor rent their garments, neither the king nor any of his servants that heard all these words. And so eventually the message of warning is going to go to the king. The king hates it. The king instructs it to be torn up with a penknife, a scribe's knife, and it's ripped up and thrown in the fire. And nobody rents their clothes at this. Now, this is kind of shocking, because what happened in the fourth year of Jehoiakim? You can go over to the book of Daniel and chapter 1 and verse 1. It talks about, now these things happened in the third year of Jehoiakim. Daniel was written from Babylon. This book, Jeremiah, was written from Judah. They had different ways of counting years, the ascension year and the non-ascension year. That's the reason why there's a difference here between Daniel 1 and the fourth year, and it says third year there. But it's the same time. And so Nebuchadnezzar had come. Jeremiah's prophecies were already in part being fulfilled. The nation was being plucked up now. And armed with that foreknowledge of Jeremiah, obviously this is Jeremiah's being vindicated, partly vindicated by the words that were written down by Baruch, and the king decided to toast it. And those around him did not rent their clothes. They weren't shocked by it. They didn't decide, well, I'm going with God, not the king. They still sided with the king. And so what did Baruch have to do? Chapter 20, verse 27, the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah after that the king had burned the roll, and the words which Baruch wrote at the mouth of Jeremiah, saying, take you again another roll. And write in it all the former words that were in the first roll. You're going to write it out again, which Jehoiakim the king had burned, but you're also going to add something else. You're going to talk about the demise of Jehoiakim, and you're going to talk about his family line on the throne of David being cut off, and it being going jumping up back to Zedekiah. So you can see verse 32 concluding this. Then took Jeremiah another roll and gave it to Baruch the scribe, the son of Neriah, who wrote therein from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the book which Jehoiakim, king of Judah, had burned in the fire. And there were added besides unto them many like words. God intensified the message, as you would, as a loving father. You would intensify the message because you knew what was coming. God, in fact, was bringing it about to correct Judah. Yet here was the opportunity for individuals to respond, individuals to decide that they were going to go with God's power and support the prophet Jeremiah, rather than seeking great things for themselves. The reality of this prophecy, that these things were coming unto pass at that time, surely impacted Baruch as well, to throw his lot in with Jeremiah. And this was not a sad mission after Baruch did this. I mean, you can read chapter 32, the other chapter that really heavily features Baruch. It talks about even when Jeremiah is shut up in prison in the final year before Jerusalem's destroyed, that he's going to go and buy a parcel of land in Anathoth so that in the future, as a sign that in the future, Judah, they're going to come back. This land is going to be inhabited again. This is not a message of doom. Yes, there's a time of correction, and the correction is now. And individually, they could be saved from a lot of it, even at that point. However, they would have to respond to the message. And many of them would, even in captivity, which is why they return. But Baruch himself, I mean, this was... choosing to go and deliver this message was not the end of Baruch's scribal career. It was the beginning. This is, I mean, we have the book of Jeremiah, right? Who's the most famous scribe of all time? I don't know too many. I would say Baruch is probably the most famous scribe. Somebody could correct me on that. But I, as far as I'm concerned, he's one of the most famous scribes. He wrote the book of Jeremiah. And here it is, 2,600 years later. We read about him. We read about his personal struggle to support God's work. We read about him being successful in it. And here we have the prophecy of Jeremiah, a dual prophecy that applies for us right now. So Baruch's message, his scribal work, his writing down of the book of Jeremiah, it actually transcended his own lifetime all the way to ours right now. If we're able to, as Baruch had to do, if we're able to as well, support God's work as he had to come to that understanding himself. Now this lesson of that Baruch learned, it's written up in the book Jeremiah and the Greatest Vision in the Bible. This is a book written by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, available for you for request. Just simply go to thetrumpet.com and you can search for it in the literature tab there, Jeremiah and the Greatest Vision in the Bible. It's not a huge section, but it's definitely a few pages worth meditating upon as we all consider this decision that Baruch made, the struggle that Baruch had, but then the success that he also had as an individual supporting God's man. Thank you very much for being with me for the Trumpet Daily today. Thank you very much for Mr. Stephen Flurry for allowing me to take the program, and have a wonderful day.